the people of sake actually brought me into sake.
Back in 1988, this place was actually in Ginza on the main drag.
At first, it was kind of soy sauce, it was miso.
To the point where it actually changed my life.
New Year's Day, 1989.
Not just sake as a beverage, but all the culture and history. And
welcome. You are listening to another episode of Sake on Air, the world's one and only podcast that is dedicated to delivering both insightful and in-depth dialogue about Japan's pair of iconic beverages, sake and shochu. My name is Justin Potts, and I am one of your regular hosts here at the show. And we actually have a rather special episode lined up for you this week, and so I actually wanted to take a moment to explain a little bit about what it is you're going to hear. We actually interviewed Mr. Shinichiro Shimizu, president of Shimizu Seizaburo Shoten. Most of you will probably know them more for the sake that they create, Zaku. Christopher Hughes and I spoke with him about all kinds of things related to Zaku. However, that interview was conducted in Japanese, which means that we had to find a way to make it approachable and enjoyable for our non-Japanese speaking listeners. It took us a little bit of time to put it together, but we're really, really excited to share it with you here today. We've basically gone over and dubbed the conversation. I speak the English for my part, Chris the English for his, and the voiceover for Shimizu-san was done by Shuso Imada. And Imada-san is the director of the Japan Sake and Shochu Information Center here, where we broadcast all of our episodes. He has been kind enough to lend us his voice for this recording, and so we're really, really excited to be able to finally share this interview with all of our listeners. Us being positioned here in Japan, being able to provide voices for the producers and the people on the ground here in Japan who don't necessarily have a voice to reach the larger international audience, being able to provide that, being able to support them, has been a mission of ours from the very beginning. When setting out originally, we hoped to be able to be doing something like this much more frequently. It takes a lot of work to put one of these together, and it takes a great deal of resources. So we hope that you will take the time to listen through the episode and let us know if this is something that you're really interested in. If it is, it'll take us a little time, but I'd really like to find a way to be able to bring this type of content to you all with a bit more frequency. So with that, we will jump into our interview with Shimizu-san of Shimizu Seizaburo Shoten, makers of Zaku.
Shimizu-san, thanks so much for joining us here at Sake on Air. To get things started, would you mind first telling us about Zaku and how that particular sake came about?
We started by asking ourselves a question. Where is sake's value born? Is it upon pressing? Or perhaps the moment sake is bottled? Or when it is shipped? We concluded that it is, in fact, the moment it touches our lips. Another way of saying it is that sake has no real value until we come in contact with it as a beverage. At the end of the day, sake's values is determined by the people that drinks it. That being said, the human palate alone isn't the only thing influencing our experience with sake. The food on the table, the ambience, the temperament at the time, all of these things are going to impact our perception of the beverage. In the grand scheme of things, the role of the brewery actually plays in creating this sense of value in actually relatively small. It is the people working in the restaurant, the chefs, the craftsmen on the drinking vessels. It's this combined energy that we feel truly crafts the value of the sake. The term zaku is the Chinese reading for the character, which means to craft or to create.
That actually makes a great deal of sense when you think about it. A lot of producers of many things often emphasize a sort of defining factor, but the reality is that there are really so many elements at play which affect things and influence the sake experience.
器の Absolutely.
I mentioned the drinking vessels, but let's not forget that who you are drinking with also makes dramatic difference on your impression of sake. When one person at the table says, "You need to try this, it's fantastic," there's an increased likelihood that you'll feel similarity when you experience it. At the end of the day, all I can do at the brewery is to create the contents of the bottle. Without the combined energy of all the other players, sake really has little value.
So how many people do you have brewing with you now?
At present, about 14 people.
And that includes the Toji?
That's right.
So I've heard rumors that the name Zaku, has some sort of a relationship to Gundam or something along those lines, or that relationship originally spurred a large scale interest in Zaku as a product. Is that true?
Gundam wasn't really my generation, so I'm not too familiar. But I can say that as soon as we first shipped the product, there was talk about why we had named it after a Gundam character. I did a bit of research after that and discovered that the anime was incredibly popular back when I was a university student, and it's still popular now. Even though the name of the sake isn't a direct reference, we are thankful to be associated with something that is so universally adored and that has proven to have such staying power. We didn't plan it that way. It really was pure coincidence.
So with regards to associations with the name Zaku, honestly, lately I'm really starting to associate it with award-winning sake. It seems like every time there's any sort of sake competition, Zaku is appearing at the top of the list of medal winners. What is your guys' approach to sake competitions, and how does that fit into your overall strategy or communication about the product?
Well, our current Toji is now 45 years old. He came to our brewery at 23 and became our Toji at the age of 25. Zaku was born after his arrival. It's pretty much always been one person at the helm, while a team of three people might be more accurate. Back when he first started, at a time when sake sales were an all-time low, submitting sake to contests was sort of a way to provide a bit of a motivation boost. The aim has never really been to just win awards. We just enter a regular sake. These contests are often thought of as a way to gather feedback from the market to gauge current consumers' tastes, which is, of course, important and something we are still pretty ignorant, to be honest. These contests serve as a sort of mirror of the times. For example, we are located in Suzuka City in Mie Prefecture. Suzuka is home to the Suzuka Circuit. Anyone with an interest in F1 or bike racing is probably familiar with the name. In the case of F1, engine regulations change year, forcing Honda to rethink things year in and year out. This is something these contests have in common. Regulation change, taste change. One good example of this might be how aroma is now ranked. One of the primary standard of the measurement and the annual sake award used to be acidity, but then it changed to aroma, which, like I said, reflects the times. The judges changed too. As time changed, people are probably more likely to give higher ratings to sake with the characteristics, reflecting what they enjoy in their everyday lives. This kind of insight is something these contests provide. They don't tell you everything, but I think they help to reflect and establish a standard.
I really like that idea, actually. The idea that continuing to win awards isn't necessarily a reflection of some specific timeless quality, but more the nature in which evolution preserves that timeliness.
I suppose it's more a case of being one step ahead of trends and preferences.
At the end of the day, it's more a case that people's tastes have evolved. We no longer eat Japanese food every day. We eat gyoza, we eat French food, Indian food, a variety of cuisine. Taste sensitivity is not the same as it was 100 years ago. That's why the benchmarks to satisfy those tastes is constantly changing. We have to develop a sensitivity to this.
Do you ever do any kind of food pairing related research as preparation for the competitions?
No, not at all. We hardly produce sake specifically for the competitions. We do, of course, produce special small batch sake for the contest, like an annual sake award held by the Sake and Shochu Makers Association. But for others, such as the IWC, which is all about promoting sake that is ready available, we just enter whatever in production at the time.
Sort of following the movement of your brewery and sort of the evolution from afar, according to what the internet seems to tell me, I have this impression that you guys are on the road quite often and spending a lot of time internationally. What's sort of your approach to the international market these days?
Well, let me address that this way. Do you know what percentage sake makes up of the overall share of Japanese alcoholic beverage consumption?
It has dipped below 7% now. 7% now, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah. Mm. Oh,
that's right. Less than 7%, about 6.8%, I believe. And 30% of that is special designated sake, such as Junmai and Junmai Gincho, made by a small craft sake production producers like ourselves. So 7% multiplied 30% is 2%. That means that only 2 people out of every 100 people are drinking sake in a style that we are creating. Sadly, people aren't drinking sake. Up until rather recently, sake was generally of quite poor quality at the end of the war because there was a shortage of rice. Brewers had to be very frugal when brewing with it. I feel that the industry has yet to overcome the negative impact of this. The reputation that was destroyed over the course of 30 years probably takes at least 30 years to repair. Over the last 20 or 30 years, sake has gradually begun to win acclaim, both at home and overseas. But here in Japan, we still need to wake up 98% of the market. It's not the time to be, focusing on all of our energy overseas.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, definitely.
We aren't looking enough at the other 98%. That being said, as Japanese cuisine grows popularity internationally as a part of the Japan brand, sommeliers have begun to turn their attention to sake. This is a really big opportunity. We can't ignore this chance just because there is a domestic market that we still need to tap into. We have to get out there and spread the word about sake.
I said there is indeed a lot of work that has to be done in parallel right now. I know that your sake has gathered a fair bit of attention following the G7 summit held in Mie back in 2016. What were kind of your takeaways from having Zaku up on a stage of that nature?
The event naturally attracted lots of media attention, but that's because 7 years earlier, at the previous summit held in Toyako in 2008, Isochiman from Shizuoka Prefecture had been selected for the toast. Japan is no stranger to a major summit or international gatherings, but the choice of toast had never made headline before the Toyako summit in Hokkaido. That's because up until then, they had always used champagne. They probably dined on French cuisine and were served wine as well. Ever since Japan made a sort of international debut at the Rokumeikan back in Meiji era, that's how they have been doing things. It's taken 150 years ago for it to happen, but Japan is finally doing what seems to be so obvious, serving its own cuisine and sake on the international stage. The fact that people in Japan are surprised by the decision and that it's making headline is, shall we say, interesting.
Yeah, serving your own cuisine and local beverage in your own country for an event like this, I think for most people it seems like it would be a given. But the reality is that in Japan, it hasn't been the case for a long time, and arguably, I guess it still isn't.
Even though there's such a big chance to introduce sake overseas.
There are lots of reasons why this is only happening now. Until sake actually started to garner positive responses internationally, Japanese people probably lacked the confidence.
I have a question, Shimizu-san. Roughly what percent of your sales are local? And historically, have there been any changes in the market?
Well, speaking only about Zaku, we first concentrated on our efforts on building sales in Tokyo. Thanks to its success and the capital, Zaku is now also gaining popularity back home in Mie. Even popular tourist destinations such as Ise Shrine and in Toba, where local sake has never had much presence, they've started carrying out products. I don't have the exact sales figures on hand right now, but sales are also good back home, I think.
Yeah, because I was just really wondering, when a brewery changes their name like you have, how local people react to this. And after using the same brand name for such a long time, surely their reaction might be, why did you change the name? What happened to the other one? Perhaps the name change even distances the brand from the local people a little bit. What has that been the case?
Well, that's right. In addition to the national share I mentioned a moment ago, there is something called the regional share, the proportion of sake production and consumed within the local region. In Tohoku, it is quite high at around 80 to 85%. In Akita, they really only drink Akita-made sake. Some goes for Yamagata. However, in Mie Prefecture, it's a mere 90%, 19%. This is pretty due to Mie's proximity to the big production producers in Nara and Fushimi. The most important thing in that people are finally starting to drink local sake at local tourist destinations. This is a very positive trend.
I guess not only with regards to consumption, but also production, sake was, for the most part, for a very long time, comprised of ingredients that were gathered from all over with no real sense of needing to emphasize local in any way. And as that sort of starts to change, how are you seeing Mie as a sake region?
Following the end of the war, everything centered around Tokyo. Recently, that's finally starting to change. And more people are beginning to pay attention to various regions around the country. Our positioning as a local jizake fits with that nicely. No one ever asked where their TV comes from, or, for example, where a Sony TV was made. But when it comes to sake, people always want to know it's important to inject that regionality into the products. We once tried using a proximity to Suzuka Circuit, but the response wasn't so positive. When we asked people why, the response was that sake produced in the place with all those fumes and noises didn't sound like it was going to taste very good. It taught us that motorsports and sake don't really mix. But the race circuit is only about 50 years old. The Suzuka region's culture dates much farther back and are overflowing with traditional industries and crafts. For example, calligraphy ink. The only other place in Japan where this is considered a traditional industry is Nara. We also have what is called Ise Katagami, a traditional kimono pattern, popular during the Edo era. The artist first takes some Japanese paper and make it waterproof using persimmon juice. Then they take a chisel and cut patterns into it to create a stencil over which they then paint. 100% of kimono patterns in Edo era were made like this in Suzuka City. We are now trying to incorporate those into our label design or on the bottles to let people know that this old culture exists.
You're starting to see a lot more sake breweries actually really begin to think about the appearance and the design and the aesthetic of the bottle, the label, just the overall presentation. When you look at a bottle of Zaku, you can tell that you guys have been thinking about this as well.
Design is really important. It's the first thing that the consumer sees, and it's a powerful tool used to communicate a message. That's why we are incorporating elements like the Suzuka ink and Ise Katagami into our products. About 5 years ago, we hired a professional designer, and with his help, designs are slowly evolving. However, the basic Zaku label has hardly changed from when it was first introduced 20 years ago. The person behind the design is me, actually. The designer said it was already complete and didn't need to change, to my relief.
Really? Do you have some sort of background in design or anything?
No, not particularly. Ask the local calligraphy artist to provide the characters, and then I just assembled them. The final label is actually modeled after a vertical hanging scroll. The bottles sort of fill in the space you often see around these scrolls. I wanted to create something with a Japanese feel to it. There are plenty of fantastic wine bottles designs in the world, but if we were to just copy these, we would lose our identity. I settled on that design to ensure we left our stamp on it.
So the name Zaku, honestly, it has a really nice ring to it. A lot of the names of a lot of different sake brands, the names of the producers, they're hard to remember, they're hard to read, they're hard to pronounce. A lot of times the name of the producer is different from the name of the product. It's really challenging, not just for people internationally, but even a lot of people in Japan can't read the names of a lot of the titles, a lot of the names of a lot of the sake. Zaku just has this really universal sense to it. It seems just really incredibly logical. Just the communication around that just feels just very smart. It's very approachable.
Thanks a lot. When we first released Zaku, we decided not to print Junmai or Junmai Ginjo on the front label. The producer is free to display the grade based on the polishing ratio. But in fact, this is pretty irrelevant information for the customers. Yes, so the so-called grade might clearly be different. But this is really just a pricing index. Whether sake is a Junmai or a Junmai Ginjo doesn't necessarily communicate the value in the bottle. So we decided that the only thing we would display on the front label is the main brand Zaku, and perhaps a smaller sub-brand in order to help the customer differentiate between the products. The decision wasn't very popular at first. People said it wasn't very clear. One of our Zaku sake carries the name Miyabi no Tomo. The Chinese character for Tomo is actually borrowed from the name of our Toji, Tomohiro Uchiyama. When he first became Toji, we asked him to treat the sake as if it were his child. Writing the poem, we included a character from his name in the name of the sake. the depiction of kanji character is really intended to represent the character of the sake. Chinese characters are great because they carry actual meaning. Everyone interprets them a bit differently. So that was also part of the message we want to convey.
Can I ask, I don't know if you can say, but is the Toji someone local?
Yes, he's from Suzuka City.
I see. And was this a chance meeting or was it part of a recruitment drive?
He's local, but he was actually attending a biotechnology college in Nagoya at the time. I don't think he ever aspired to become a Toji, but during his 2 years of study there, he attended a lecture on fermentation sake at a prefectural research institution. The particular professor was constantly recommending employment in the sake industry. So many of his friends ended up working in that capacity. It took a bit of time, but he eventually made his way to us about three years later.
And seeing as how the other employees are quite young, is there a focus now on recruiting mainly young people?
We have employed older staff before, and we started with an older team when we developed Zaku. But recently, we have been thinking about our next Toji. Our current Toji is now 45 and will be 60 in 15 years' time. He told us that he wants asked to find someone around 20, because he sees little point in trying to train someone who is already in their 30s or 40s. However, before he can take on extra stuff, we need to increase our volume. Luckily, production has increased little by little in recent years, so I'm optimistic that we'll soon be in a position to create some new jobs, make some new hires, and in turn, create more work.
And that's actually, you touch on a really important point in that, I mean, brewing great sake is, of course, it's naturally, that's a given. But creating an industry of opportunity that the younger generation, as well as people from different fields and different backgrounds want to be a part of, is arguably maybe one of the most pressing challenges for the industry right now. Is there anything in particular that you're focusing your energy on in that regard?
The reality is that we at the brewery don't have much connection to the younger generation, but we really have to communicate sake to the next generation. Without that, sake has no future. So we try to do what we can to take advantage of such opportunities.
This is a little bit off topic, but I personally wanted to ask you because I was really curious about it. In the past, I know you created a sake called Concentration, which is rather unique on a number of levels, it seems. Would you mind explaining that sake to us just really briefly?
The creation of concentration came about when we were approached by Mitsubishi Chemical about creating a sake together that would showcase Japanese crafts and technology to coincide with G7 Summit in Ese. Their idea and approach were really interesting, so we decided to go for it. I can't really speak to the technical process behind it, but it uses something called zeolite membrane, which acts as sort of a sieve at the particle level. Basically, alcohol particles, as well as all the major flavor constituents that help define sake, such as sweetness and the amino acid responsible for umami, are separated from the water particles, resulting in a high alcohol beverage with a very highly concentrated flavor profile. In distillation, a lot of this flavor constituent would evaporate. However, using this technology, we are able to create a sake, a brewed fermented beverage, with a uniquely concentrated profile.
So it doesn't just result in accentuating the flavor and the aroma characteristics. It actually results in something that is more concentrated, right? Hence the name, I guess.
どうやって飲んでもらうか。
That's right. So we ended up with sake that has 30% ABV. The question that then became, how do we ask people to drink that? It's a sake that demands its own drinking style in order to be relevant. For high ABV villages, such as spirits, you might add ice or water. But the product is so flavorful, we instead propose to enjoy it straight, something like a digestive, to sip on following the meal. You can chill it and sip it on alongside dessert. We created custom glassware as well, similar to glassware that you might associate more with liqueurs.
It's interesting because the industry in general right now has sort of been beginning to skew toward lower ABV, something more in the ballpark of 12 to 14%, closer to wine. And you guys took a completely different direction, which is I think it's exciting.
Very innovative, really.
So, Shimizu-san, I know you need to get going here, and I don't want to take up too much of your time, but is there any final message or anything that you'd like to share with our listeners about the future of Zaku?
Well,
it might not be appropriate for the end of the interview, but so about 20 years ago, the Toji and I went to Tokyo and visited our suppliers with samples of our sake. A lot of the suppliers said that although they thought it was a good textbook sake, it lacked individuality, and that they wished it had a bit more of Toji's own personal touch. At that time, he was 25, I was 40. On the way home, I told him, you can ignore those comments, to suggest that someone in their 20s who has just begun brewing should be adding personal touch to the sake makes no sense. Doing so wouldn't result in a sake with a personal touch. It would just be a novelty. The great thing about being young is that if you ask the people around you with more experience how to do something, they'll teach you. If someone in their 40s does that, the response will be, what on earth have you been doing for these last 20 years? So I just told him, there's nothing wrong with textbook style sake. Follow the textbook. Keep asking questions. Ask people to teach you about making Yamaha or Kimoto style sake. But in the process, when you detect something that feels out of place, make a mental note. Chip away at those things little by little. Through the process, over time, you will end up with something that defines Zaku.
Shimizu-san, thank you so much for your time this evening. It was fantastic having you out. We hope you'll come back and join us one of these days, and we look forward to seeing where Zaku goes from here.
ありがとうございました。
わざわざ、はい、ありがとうございました。またぜひ、待ての機会にもぜひまたいらしてください。はい、またよろしくお願いします。ありがとうございました。
And there you have it. That wraps up our interview with Shimizu-san, the president of Shimizu Seizaburo Shoten, the makers of Zaku. We would love to hear what you think. Please do send us your feedback to questions@sakeonair.com. If you would like to follow along with us on our sake adventures on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, please do so. You can find us at sakeonair. If you'd be so kind as to take a moment out of your day to write a kind review on whatever platform you're listening to this on, that would be greatly appreciated. Otherwise, we will be back here in a couple of weeks. Sake on Air is brought to you together with the wonderful support of the Japan Sake and Shochu Makers Association and broadcast from the Japan Sake and Shochu Information Center in Tokyo, Japan. Thanks again for listening, and kanpai!